You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Much, if not most, of the intelligentsia would do.
Literacy as a form of awareness is a highly specialist and objective sort of thing.
Commodification is not simply an asymmetric relation of power.
Could you elaborate on this thing? Could you elaborate on this? Perhaps go and work, okay?
Wait a minute, why can't I get my opinion? This is a free country.
He can give you. Do you have to give it so loud?
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Janitor's Library podcast. I'm Patrick Higgins.
And I'm Hannah Meyer.
It's been a while since we recorded the introductory episode.
Yeah. We've both been fairly busy with various obligations and, for me, overscheduling of the semester. So.
Didn't you also have like a sinus infection or something?
Yeah, I had a tonsil infection.
Oh, that was it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's over now. But when it happened, it was like pretty rough. So.
Yeah. So I guess we're doing broadly as the topic the idea of like emotion or like emotional labor or like what kinds of emotion are like costs work to like express.
Yeah, I think we're
culture.
Yeah, we're going to go back to the history of emotional labor because it was first sort of coined in 1983. But I think at the beginning, we're going to sort of talk broadly about critical theory as a sort of general overview.
Yeah. So with critical theory, generally when I've heard it meant, like, when I've seen, you know, a genealogy of it or whatever, I find it starting specifically, well, I mean, some people will put it as far back as like Hegel or Kant because they're doing like, you know, critiques, they're doing like critique of pure reason or whatever, but I think that usually when it's referred to in the like academic context that we use it now, it goes back to the Frankfurt School, which are like the 20th century Marxists who basically started after like World War One happens and everything's obviously terrible, and they're like, well, the worst thing ever that should obviously start a revolution happened, but why didn't we have a revolution except like this one in Russia that doesn't make any sense because it's a peasant country. So they were like, we should start analyzing culture to find out, like, why, like, how is capitalism, like, intersecting with culture, and, like, how do people interact with it, and, like, what is, they, like, we're interested in psychoanalysis and stuff. So that's, like, Theodore Adorno and Horkheimer, and Walter Benjamin is sort of there, but he's, like, on the outskirts doing hashish and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to think of critical theory as a process of illumination and sort of being able to look at, yeah, like, not only just, like the world, but also I think it's a critical theory, I think, also always becomes sort of, like, personal in a way. Like, there's this idea of me-search and how people, when they do critical theory or any sort of research, there's always some sort of, like, personal stake involved. But I think, like, this sex researcher Zhanna Vrenglova talks about that a lot. Because she researches polyamory. But I think something else that's really interesting is the ways in which that, like, while critical theory is so much about power and, like, illuminating the ways in which power operates, it's ironically, there's a lot of politics involved in the way that it gets sort of produced and how it's often, like, gatekept linguistically. like bell hooks. I know that you like don't like her, but she talks about how there's like a privilege to name something, and how like those in power have the privilege to name. So therefore, there's this entire, there's like so many experiences that are like left out within critical theory, and now there's kind of like a reemergence of people of color and like women in academia, but it still definitely leans towards like, because like oftentimes what is considered critical theory is like the most jargonistic and abstract forms of writing. So I think those politics are really fascinating.
Yeah. Usually I've seen historically two major kind of branches of critical theory. Because there's like modernist critical theory, which is usually like used with a capital C, capital T. And that's like specifically critical theory that's engaged in asking about like how capitalism functions. Like that stems directly from like the Marxist tradition, and like individual consciousness under capitalism. And then there's kind of what's generally referred to as the postmodern tradition, which is what happens with like the post-structuralists like Foucault and to some extent Derrida. He's not really a post-structuralist. He's like a post-phenomenologist, I guess. But like that kind of break that happens after Althusser in the French Academy. It's also one of those things that also just gets like used if you're just like a sociologist who works through like denouncing something.
Yeah.
Like in a way, like kind of like, that's kind of like more what Foucault did, I guess. Like, cause like the idea being like, the definition I have here for the postmodern tradition is situating social problems in historical and cultural contexts to implicate themselves in the process of collecting and analyzing data and to relativize the findings.
Mm-hmm. And then I think like postmodern critical theory is much more interdisciplinary. Modernist.
I mean, a lot of the like post-colonial studies and stuff comes kind of, the contemporary tradition of that comes out of it to some extent.
Yeah.
Largely.
Yeah. What do you think, like, which critical theories do you think have like impacted your thinking both like academically and also even like interpersonally the most?
I started reading more of the post-structuralist tradition, but like a lot of that I was reading more out of the part that was literature based rather than sociologically based. So I was reading more like Jacques Derrida on his like more like Jacques Derrida's stuff on like specific works of literature, and like the Julia Kristeva I've read is more of her like stuff about like Carnival and stuff and like genre and traditions of writing rather than her like more later sociological stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then like my like personal favorite writer Molly Sponshaw, who kind of inspired most of that stuff. In terms of my politics, I follow much more the modern, which is like more obvious because my politics are Marxist. I'm a communist, so like I'm like, oh yeah, like that school, like though I follow kind of in, there's a particular branch of communism, the left-wing communism. And there's movements like autonomism and Antonio Negri and stuff that comes out of Italy that is a combination of the two, like Deleuze and Guattari both influenced that, and that it's very interested in the ideas of like how do you form movements and communities that don't restrict the individual, but also kind of like, how do you form a politics based on cutting through to the bare like nature of like, oh, we're all dissatisfied and have needs that aren't being met, and that's what we want to address. Like, how do you work in the field of communication to get that towards an actual politics, kind of? So it has kind of a mix of them to some extent.
Yeah. Because I think just based on my conversations with you, I think you're definitely one of the most Marxist-leaning people that I know.
I went to school with one of the people in my theater group was a Marxist, and I had a couple other friends that were, but I didn't actually really change my political stances to the actual left until like basically graduating.
Okay.
College. Yeah. Basically once I figured out that liberal isn't the same thing as left, I realized that my politics weren't actually aligned with most of
what I was voting for. Liberalism is basically like neoliberalism or just centrism, and it's not like actual left.
Yeah. Leftness. I mean, if you look historically, both internationally and in America specifically, the Democratic Party right now is basically a hardcore centrist party, just with nothing to the opposite side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there's not really any sort of movement or political project right now, but people are working on that, and I've been trying to keep a pulse on it. And that was like a lot of the people I met at the, there was the Jordan Peterson conference thing that happened at BSU.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of the people that are kind of, cause that was the one that had like the Zero Books guys, Michael Brooks, who's hosts another podcast, generally trying to figure out like, where does the left want to go, and like, can we do something to get our own kind of public presence in the way that Jordan Peterson has got, that's coherent.
Yeah, because even like Octavio Cortez, who people think of as radical, isn't that left-leaning. Like, it's like she's more like, she's like less centrist than like most people, but like not, she's really comparable to not Obama actually, but like,
well, the whole like, a lot of, I've heard people point out that a lot of people that identify now as social Democrats or democratic socialists or whatever, like basically like the Bernie Sanders-esque version of like what we call socialism, a lot of it's more like internalized Keynesian stuff, just like a lot of like it's the new deal, like a lot of socialized public socialized public services, but like, to that I'm always like, yeah, but when do I get to own the means of production?
Yep. That's
actually the definition of socialism is the workers own the means of production. But yeah. I mean it's generally good, I think, but it's I know that there was a thing, like Bernie Sanders, there was like some article he wrote about needing like a new progressive international movement, which I'm like, yeah, that would be good. And then the Marxist International will come in afterwards. Set up the gulags, but...
Yep.
Yeah. I know that you mentioned... I mean, when we talk, I know that you've often brought up, like, Chris Deva and Butler and those...
Yeah.
That crew...
Mm-hmm. Yep, that clan. Yeah, I think, because I remember I was doing dramaturgy for this play that Gertrude Stein wrote called Listen to Me, and the director, who's also, I think he wrote his undergraduate thesis on Chris Deva. He, like, recommended Desire and Language, and then since then I, like, read more of her work afterwards for my thesis and that prospectus. But I think in terms, I think a lot of my sort of like interest in critical theory typically sort of stem from like ideas about gender and power. And I think there's definitely like my own identity, obviously, and my own sort of obsession with like power dynamics in general life, I think really informs that. So I feel like basically if you read any of my essays, you could really like psychoanalyze me pretty well. Yeah. And I think I also, there's also this professor, Irina Kartsaki, who teaches at Queen Mary, who writes about repetition. And how, when you repeat something multiple times in theater, like the meaning becomes illuminated, but through like the subconscious associations of the idea. But yeah, she's like also a really solid person. Yeah.
That's actually one of the big breaks between modern and postmodern critical theory, is like modern theorists. Like Frederick Jameson has written a lot about this. They're like, they have like the dialectical model, whereas postmodern ones usually focus on difference and repetition, as in I don't know how you pronounce his name. French names confuse me. Jai Deleuze's book, Difference and Repetition.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that you can do something, you can repeat something over and over again, and yet it will still be different and stuff.
Yeah, and I think people, like, I think the other thing is, like, people, like Gertrude Stein does, like, a lot of repetition, and I feel like if you, like, know the theory, it's more interesting, but I think repetition, for the sake of repetition, I think it's, like, some people... I think a lot of it depends on, like, on the viewer. Like, there's this group called Forest Entertainment, a performance art collective from the UK, and they do a lot with, like, repetition. Like, they did this, like, game show sequence for, like, repeating for, like, 2.5 hours. And, like, some people would, like, walk out. I thought it was really interesting. But I think, like, repetition is, like, inherently painful to watch. But it can also be, like, very funny and, like, also very dark in a lot of ways. But I think sometimes it's sort of dismissed as being, like, just for the sake of, like, the aesthetics, which I don't think is a very fair sort of accusation.
Well, I think, like, any artistic thing, it depends on how it's used. And also, I know, like... There's also a bit, that's another thing that's like a big divide in terms of like the question of to what degree when repetition is used as an aesthetic, there's a revolutionary idea to it, but it can also be used to convey reactionary ideas.
Yeah.
About like I know that Walter Benjamin, even though I think he kind of liked Nietzsche, but he talked about like his issue with the eternal return is that the problem with any sort of reactionary myth is like it's all about returning to something and like an inevitable return. Mm-hmm. And he thought that even though Nietzsche was trying to like escape that he like the idea of having this eternal cosmic return of things repeating just internalized that in a way. And like some people have written about like the like that tension of like is the repetition something you escape from, or is it something that like is seductive?
I say it's both. Like Kundera talks a lot about this in The Unbearable Lightness of Being, where like Sabina has there's this repetition of like the bowler hat, and it symbolizes like the communist state and her father and all of her lovers, and she uses it in this like S&M sort of way, so it becomes, he sort of like equates it with music. And because people do often like find like patterns for the sake of sort of like rationalizing, I guess, like poetic elements of their lives, and that can be like sort of seductive but also like an entrapment depending on like what like said repetition is. But
gosh, I'm trying to think of what the piece was on it. I know there was something I read or listened to recently that was talking about the issue of repetition, but I can't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. I know I've heard a lot about like the, because I think it was Blanchot, or maybe it was Deleuze and Guattari, I don't remember. We were talking about like the problem of like contemporary politics being that the only sort of like definitive political step that can happen is like an actual full like break with like the current of like contemporary history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but that by its own necessity means that we can't tell what it's going to be, so the only like actions we have are those that attempt to like sow like the seeds of like what could happen in the future that we can't understand or predict given our current like circumstances. And like,
okay,
like the idea, like, so like it's like this idea that like you need to have like find revolutionary action in the current like repetition of how the world is right now that seems inescapable in order to produce a break that we can't like foresee.
Yeah. Because I think we're almost hardwired to sort of like find like meaning and repetition, even if it's not there, just for the sake of like having like some sort of like semblance of meaning, I think.
Yeah, but that, I think that brings in the issue of like, to some degree, the function of critical theories then to like break down the assumptions of meaning that occur.
Yeah.
There.
Yes.
Like, I don't know, like, one of my big things. I like say, like someone was saying, talking about like critical theory in relation to the culture wars, and I like came to the conclusion that I'm not, I don't want culture wars, I want war on all culture. There's like a... Well, to me, like, anytime that you talk about, like, culture, all you're talking about is, like, really the way that the assumptions of the way the world works are, like, crystallized into material things. Either, like, material, like, either objects or, like, methods of communication or rituals or language or whatever. And I don't think that it works to necessarily say that what, like, we should just be trying to hold up one set of assumptions to show that another one is bad. I think we have to realize that ultimately, like, all of these cultural things are going to constantly need to be critiqued and broken down, regardless of one or the other. Like, there's a quote... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. But also goes back to, like, phenomenology and how, like, each person's experience with, like, a cultural manifestation is different because of their identity and their sort of own specific engagement with said constructs. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if phenomenologists would say that it's based on your identity connection to it.
I guess not identity, but I guess, like, specific individual experiences.
Yeah, I mean, if you're... Because, I mean, for, like, if you're following through the Heideggerian, like, sentence, it's, like, your Dasein, your being. As a... Your being as being reflecting on itself. But, yes. Like, there's a... The last... Like, there's a quote from, like, a piece by Walter Benjamin that's, like, one of, ironically, one of the pieces of literature that I return to. That's his thesis on the concept of history, which was, I think, the... It wasn't the very last thing he wrote before he killed himself, but very close, I think. But he has a quote in it where he says, like, every object of culture is an object of barbarity or something. Like, where he, because his conception of history is, like, he talks about every single thing that we've had that's been brought to us down through history has an entire lineage of pain to bring it to us that we don't see in the object or in the cultural representation.
Yeah.
And he sees the... So it's interesting because even though he comes out of the Frankfurt School, he kind of, like, has this weird intersection of, like, predicting some of the, like, postmodern parts of it, where he says, like, you... To be historically, like, engaged with something is to, like, reveal how all the assumptions we have about the object are historically placed in a point where there's always going to... There's never been a point in human history that didn't have suffering or oppression occurring.
Wait, what year did he write that?
It was 1940, I think. Because he killed himself right after the Nazis invaded Paris.
Okay, so, like, right around, like, the modernist, postmodern sort of era.
Because he's part of the, like, first movement of critical theory. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, it was written in early 1940.
This is, like, definitely right on the cusp.
That was when all the other modernist critical theorists left Germany and came to mostly Los Angeles. Except him, he was the only one that didn't get out. Yeah, but he's interesting because he thinks that, like, he also talks a lot about, like, image. Like, he thinks that, like, we don't, like, we need to get out of, like, thinking in terms of, like, signs and symbols, and we need to have, like, full images.
Mm-hmm. So that's almost with, like, Artaud's line of thinking of having, like, perception being spectacle-based as opposed to language-based.
Yeah, in some ways. I don't know if he ever talked to... I know that Benjamin... Was it like he was in Paris around the time that the Surrealists were, and he was inspired by them, though he was also critical of them in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he does talk about, like, he talks about not spectacle so much as, like, what he calls distraction, or, like,
okay,
a useful kind of distraction, where he thought that, like, he was, like, really into, like, film, and he thought that film was, like, super important, and he talked about, like, the power of film is that it, like you can't, like, as you're watching it, you're thinking about it simultaneously, but things are changing as you're thinking about it. So he said that there's this kind of, like, distraction to film that makes you keep thinking more rather than, like, making you stop thinking.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you're like, oh, look at that thing on screen. I'm thinking about, oh, there's, like, something new, but I'm connecting what I saw before to what I saw now, and I'm, like, building this chain of associations kind of thing. Like, he talked about, like, he thought that, like, the Dadaists and, like, the stuff with montage, he was, like, he thought, like, early, not montage, collage. He thought that, like, collage was, like, the attempt to do what film does, like, before they had the actual resources to do it.
Hmm. Interesting.
It just, like, didn't have the temporal aspect to it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he talked a lot about, like, we could honestly do a whole episode on his thesis on the concept of history. It's super awesome piece where he, like, talks about, like, he had, like, a Paul Klee painting of, like, this angel called Angelus Novus that he was, like, inspired by throughout his whole life that he would go back to, and he, like, used it as, like, a, like, meditative thing that he would, like, return to. But he talks about, like, the image of history for him is, like, he says, like, there's this angel that's, like, facing backwards into the past, and all of the past is one giant catastrophe with, like, rubble building up, and the angel wants to, like, reach back and redeem it, but the winds of progress prevent it from going back.
That's really jarring, actually. Like... Wait, is there, do you know, like, which painting it was, like, who did it?
It's called Angelus Novus by Paul Klee.
Angels. Okay. Right, so, emotional labor. That. Yeah, while I was abroad, we read part of The Managed Heart in this class that had to do with, it was called Cultural Politics and Performance. It was a prime time in my life. So basically, Arlie Hochschild wrote this book in, like, 1983, and that's where the term emotional labor first started. And she, her interest was largely in the work sphere. And she wrote about flight attendants who had to constantly be regulating their own emotions in order to get their jobs done. And there was one particular case study where there was this woman who was a flight attendant and she had to be smiling and gregarious the entire time. And so at night she was unable to sleep and she would have to like go and she'd be going out to parties and she couldn't stop laughing because of the affect that she had to be performing the entire day. And then the manager also talks about like women and low income workers who are expected to fix up other people's feelings and aren't recognized or compensated for it. So there really is it's like a real health cost, psychologically and also physically, in terms of sleep when it comes to emotional labor. And then we'd also like, go ahead.
Do you know, does she write about, like, what do you call them? I guess you would say telemarketers, or like the people who like when you're on the phone, like have to be nice to you to like.
I don't know. Actually,
I'm just thinking about because there's that movie that came out.
Yeah.
The Sorry to Bother You.
Mm-hmm.
Came out.
Yeah.
It's all about that.
Yeah, but I definitely think so. Like, because like Arlie Hochschild is American, and I think the way in which people are expected to perform in production spheres in the States versus the UK is entirely different because there's like a completely different emotional expectation. And I think it's definitely gendered too in terms of like how much emotional involvement we expect women to have in the production space versus in the UK. But I think that also transcends to like interpersonally and how women are expected to sort of be managing everyone's feelings. But a lot of the time it's really difficult to sort of pinpoint what is emotional labor because so much of it is just sort of ingrained and sort of like through gender roles and through socialization. So there's so much of it that like really is invisible.
Yeah, I've always been interested in that thing about, because definitely, there's definitely, like, in the UK and Europe, there's, like, that, just, like, a very clear, like, if you're in the service sector, they don't have the kind of expectation of kind of falsified, like, gregarious, like, there's still, like, a politeness, but it's not, it's almost, like, more, like, militarized or something. Like, it's, like, it's very, like, because I remember when I was in London, I went to, like, do the whole, like, me and my family went to do, the whole, you get high tea at, like, one of the fancy places that's famous for, like, doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the service, it's, like, they come up and they're, like, oh, like, this is what we have, this is this, and then they leave, and then they come back and they're, like, do you have what you want? And you say it, they leave. Like, they don't have, like, this whole, like, banter of, like, oh, I hope you're having a great day. Like, do we all know what we want? Like that, like, it's very like I am here to do the job and like tell you like I'll answer your questions if you have them. I will give you your food. Like, it's not, there's not this whole like false attempt at like engagement that's required.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in performance studies, there's the whole idea of how it has to seem like genuine, because if it seems forced, everyone can sense it. So if it's like almost like it's overly performative, it doesn't work. But then if it sort of is too subdued, it doesn't work. So it has to be, people have to like perceive it as honest, which almost takes sort of like more emotional exertion than just like faking it. Yeah, and I think when I was in the UK, it might just be like my own personality, but I think it's much more relaxing because everyone just feels much more calm.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, did you work the box office at PSU, at ISF?
I did not.
Oh.
No.
I hated that so much.
Really?
Like, I hated, like, the, because they're all, like, old white people who like yes. have this very clear sense of like how you're supposed to be polite to them. And I was just like, just let me just like get your tickets and like get you on your way and like not have to worry about all this bullshit.
I know, because then there's like the expectation of like having like almost like a full-on like conversation that's not even like a yeah. but it's like so it's over the phone, so it's inherently like meaningless, and also just because, and you're like aware of that, but yeah. like yeah, but it's also bizarre how like when you're on the phone and how you can like, and that's not even that, but I think in general you can sort of like sense what emotional labor people want from you, and yeah. I imagine yeah, but some people actually like those environments of sort of emotional exertion.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also, it just points to like also how commoditized like social engagement is now. Like the way that you go out and engage people is by buying things. Like
yeah.
You walk around downtown and buy things with like your friends, or like get your like or like looking at like, which is it? I think Dutch Bros is like the one that's like super infamous for like how like overly happy they have to be, and like how extremely like invested they like are in anything yes. you bring up. Like
yeah,
and like it's such a like, that's like how you like you don't need friends, you just need like the cool barista that will like get you what you want but like fulfill your social engagements.
Yeah, I think I know someone who worked at Subway, and like I think they were required to say like hi, welcome to Subway in the first like 5 seconds yeah. that someone would come in. So it was definitely like timed and like almost like militarized in a way.
Yeah.
But I also think there are sort of like production's fears or like Flying M, where people kind of like know each other, and there's a different dynamic because people know each other in like different contexts yeah. outside of just that sphere.
Yeah, well, I mean, like it is an intersection of things because of like, because like you can have legitimate social interaction in the sense of like, if you're going to, for those that are listening that aren't in Boise, Flying M is like a local independent coffee house. Like if you go to the Flying M, you're like, yeah, you're gonna know people there usually because there's like a very particular crowd of people that like you see a lot, and like usually people go with friends, or like even if you don't go with friends, there's a sense of like, oh, that person that is usually here pretending to write their novel kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
So there that is happening, but it's still like it's a weird point where it's still happening, and like I've always been like fascinated by the weird trend of like Flying M and other coffee shops where it's like the gift shop is like in the main part too. Like you sit and like stuff, but they have like that big open section of just like weird kitsch that you can buy.
Yeah.
Like it's very like, it's a very weird, like instead of it being like you socialize, like it's not entirely integrated, but it's not like a like you socialize and then there's like a wall of products behind you or something. It's like you sit in and amongst like all these yeah. like things.
Well, because like the whole like, I guess like the institution, for lack of a better word, like is like you kind of, not that you like, as someone who loiters at Flying M, like you don't technically have to like spend money to be there, but like people, there's like the, because there's like a lot of, I don't know, to me at least, like Flying M, I feel like has the most, it's the most like community oriented coffee house that I know of, especially in Boise. So there's like the juxtaposition, I guess, of like intimacy and like community, but also like in a heavily like production oriented yeah. sphere. And there's like the giant half with like the gift shop.
Yeah.
So it's kind of bizarre. And I think like if someone, I feel like if a non-human being came and sort of observed the emotional labor in the US, it would be really jarring
yeah,
to them.
Although it's also like, I'm curious. My family hosted a, they weren't a refugee, but they were like a, I think that they were like working with like the, like Idaho Refugee like Center, but they were from, they weren't from India. Where were they from? Cambodia, maybe? I can't remember specifically. Myanmar. I think they were from Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I think that, I think it was, they did work helping with like sexual assault survivors and stuff who came to other, you know, escaped. But like, when they were coming, and they were younger, they were like my age, but like when they were coming, like they had like, you know, like stuff about like, you know, be aware that in, you know, a lot of the Eastern Asian cultures, there's like a thing about like, you don't usually say no, like you want to say yes, because it's like a respect thing.
Hmm.
Like
the, just like to anything.
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, like if it's like, but like the sense of like, oh, did you like the food? Do you want more food? Like, there's an inherent, like, you say yes because it's disrespectful to, like, and again, like, I don't know how, to what degree this is actually fully carried over in, like, more modernized, like, parts or what, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. But it, that's definitely, like, part of, the, like, the tradition of that. Especially, like, especially I think it's, like, if you're in someone else's house, like,
yeah,
kind of thing. Because I know, also, like, my brother-in-law, when he studied in Japan, he would talk about, like, how when he was eating with his foster family, they would be like, did you like the food? And when he said yes, they would just give him more food because they automatically assumed that meant he would just, like, want to eat more.
Yeah. Because I think in the U.S., like, there's, like, there is that pressure, but it's not as, like, there's definitely a huge freedom to, like, to say no here for sure, yeah. That I think that we, like, kind of, like, take for granted. Or you wouldn't realize until you didn't have that, like, well, freedom to say that.
It's almost like a less one-sided, like, there's almost a greater degree to which everyone is expected to be fully, like, emotionally invested in everything that they're, like, talking about or that's going on. Like in that kind of relationship, like, where it's like in a culture where it's like, oh, you enter someone's house, you don't refuse things because it's considered impolite, like, you have that to some extent. But like, I feel like in an American situation, it's not unusual for like the guest can fully like the guest is like their own fully autonomous thing that can fully say yes or no at all times, but the host is also doing that.
Yeah.
And like the thing about like when you look at like airplane attendants or whatever, like part of the facade is like you're covering up the fact that it's an attempt to cover up the fact that they don't actually have any choice in what they're doing by putting in the energy of how we expect someone to pretend like I'm making this decision because I want to be like I fully autonomously decided that yes, I want to get you this cup of coffee, like,
yeah, kind of thing. Because I think because basically like it's kind of by like performing, I guess, like a state of happiness, like they're like inherently suppressing, obviously, like potential, like obviously like lethargy because plane flights can be like tedious. But I think also like the power dynamics that exists between them and everyone else who's on the flight. So they're really just sort of like erasing those dynamics. And also I think after a while you stop recognizing your own emotions and your own, especially like your own negative emotions, once you just have like the default of performing,
yeah,
a yes to everything.
And like, I know there's a book called The Magus. It's by what's his name, Foles. He wrote like The French Lieutenant's Woman. That's his famous one. He also wrote a book called The Collector, which is the Collector is a really interesting book in terms of John Foles, that's his name. That's it. Collector is a really interesting book about gender dynamics because it's about a butterfly collector who kidnaps a woman and, like, keeps her in his basement. But, like the whole thing is that, like, he, like, is, like treating her well, like, in scare quotes, like doting on her and stuff. And, it like, it's, like, this big examination of, like, the, like, psychology of it. And, like, but, like, he, in the Magus, like, one of the, at the beginning, one of the characters is, like, interacting with this woman who's a flight attendant, and she, like, talks about, like, the exhaustion, but she talks about, like, yeah, like, the difficulty of, like, having an emotional connection with anyone when you get off a plane, because you're never, like, the only place that you're permanently at is in the plane, which is never permanently anywhere else.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, have you seen Fight Club?
Yeah.
Like, there's, like, that, like, one, that great, like, one-off line, like, where he's, like, you know, like, oh, you've got your, like, single-serving coffee, single-serving friends, like, you know, you're friends with whoever you sit next to on the plane for, like, that one night, but then you, like, forget about them. But, like, the airplane attendants are the people that are always on the flight, constantly, having to, like, sort of, like, readjust themselves to being the single-serving friend every next flight.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think I wouldn't say that, like, spaces like airplanes are entirely, like, devoid of, like, any human connection, because there was this American Life episode about meeting people on airplanes and how there was like one sort of segment where people, these two people had, like, gotten engaged, and then there was someone who worked at a flight who would, like, pair people off based on their, like, what they could gauge from their, like, flight information to see if they would, like specifically, like seat assignment-wise. So I'd say, like, and there is, like, the whole idea of, like, taxi cab syndrome of, like, telling people a lot of things because you won't see them again. Mm. But at the same time, it's like, 99% of the time, like, you won't. But, like, it's not entirely impossible. And so it's almost, I think it's interesting to meet people in those spaces where it almost feels anonymous, even though it's not, and it could. It's most likely devoid of anything, but not entirely.
Have you seen the Sorry to Bother You?
No, I have not. Have you?
I haven't seen it yet. I've been meaning to, but I know I've seen, like, parts of it. I haven't seen the whole thing yet, but, like, it has, I know part of the, like, absurd pseudo surrealist thing of it is, like, because the main character is a telemarketer, and, like, whenever he calls someone, he, like, his desk and stuff, like, drops into the current, like, circumstances of the person's life that he's calling.
Okay.
So it's, like,
It's,
like, you know, he's forced to confront, like, the person that he's calling who is, like, you know, like, the single mom of, like, three kids, and he realizes, like, how much he's wasting her time and, like, annoying her. Like, it's not, like, this anonymous phone call anymore.
That's really interesting, because I think, like, that'd be interesting to analyze in relation to the Managed Heart.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, I mean, the guy that made it, Boots Riley, he's also been outright that he's a communist. So he's, like, got this very, like, it's got a very clear, like, statement in terms of, like, corporatizing social life. Because, like, they also, they work for a company that, I don't remember what it's called, but, like, the company, it's basically, like, serfdom. Like, they give you a house and, like, food and healthcare and stuff, but you just, like, work for them for life.
Whoa.
Afterwards. I need to watch the whole thing. It's a very interesting, like, thing. Like, I'm still in shock that he actually, like, got it made.
Mm-hmm. Like, and aside from what I've heard about it, it's kind of like a line, not, it's like, inherently different than Get Out, but in terms of like the social critique, I think it's in a similar field.
Yeah, I think it probably has some similarities to Get Out. I know, like, from stuff I've heard with Boots Riley, I don't know if he's, like, even the, like, the I know that Sorry to Bother You definitely has, like, it has a racial aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, part of the whole thing is the telemarketer, like, has a white voice. Like, that, like, people will buy stuff when he uses his white voice.
Yeah.
But I think his, again, because he's a communist, I think that his interpretation of, like, why racial divides are important, how they're treated, is a lot different than what Get Out would be implying.
Yeah. I think Get Out is also, you could write, like, a PhD, actually, no, on Get Out. I know someone actually who wants to teach my professors, like, entire class just on Get Out, because you totally definitely could. But I think it's definitely, like, the idea of, like, the sunken place, and I think a lot of, it's more, I'd say it's not along the lines of, like, Afrofuturism. And I don't know, I think it's, I don't know, it's its own sort of sphere. I'm not sure I was going with that, but yeah, we can honestly do, we could probably do an entire episode on Get Out, actually.
I haven't actually seen it.
I feel like you would like it a lot. It's really good.
I saw some of it and I thought it was mostly boring, but wasn't Jordan Peele, or I can't remember which one's, yeah, he's Peele, right?
Yeah,
Jordan Peele. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing like a mini series, I think, on Lovecraft County, which is like a reinterpretation of like Lovecraft horror with like racial stuff.
Like, I didn't know that.
It involves like the Ku Klux Klan and stuff. It's based off a book that I heard good things about. But before we finish up, do we want to talk about the pieces on how emotional labor is misused?
Yes. So there was an article that talked about how emotional labor, like the core concept, has been sort of dulled down, and they think that the culprit is all of these think pieces that have really harsh deadlines. And a lot of the criticism comes from the fact that people will just call anything emotional labor. Like, for example, having to sort of explain like gender politics to someone who doesn't know, and which, like, yes, that is a type of emotional labor, but like emotional labor is so situated in the market and in the production sphere that you can't really sort of ask for like actual compensation for things like explaining things to people. And then I think if people don't realize like the full weight of the term, it just becomes hollowed out.
Yeah. The particular, I think, quote that really gets the heart of what they're talking about. Listen, this one is for listeners if they want to find it. I'll see if I can, I'm still figuring out how things get uploaded. I'll see if I can maybe add it to like the show notes or whatever. This is Please Stop Calling Everything That Frustrates You Emotional Labor by Haley Swenson. It was in Slate. But there's a particular quote. Let me see if I can find it. They're talking about like I guess there was a particular piece on like someone claiming that like them explaining to their husband how they expected a household task to be done was emotional labor. And the quote is, the tendency of women to expect things to be done in particular ways is a problem that goes far beyond this marriage. The anxiety women feel about it shouldn't be confused as proof that their way of doing things is right and the men in their lives are incompetent or wrong. Sociologists have a word for the tendency of women to set the terms for how parenting of housework should take place and then policing that line in such a way that men are effectively shut out of doing it. It's called maternal gatekeeping. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. If we chalk up every dispute over how and when something should be done as to emotional labor, we might bulldoze our way past the possibility that our own expectations can be our own worst enemy. And I think it's again, like, bringing this to some degree to my Marxist leanings, like, Marx talks about labor in terms of, like, there's, like, work that you, like, you can do work or, like, labor at something without it being, like, commoditized labor.
Mm-hmm.
But what he there's something that he calls, like, socially necessary labor time, which is what, in his, like, reading, gives things, like, exchangeable value in a market. So, like, one of the, like, the kind of, like, Adam Smithian example is, like, if there's a well and one person draws up water from the well and sells it, the amount of money that the water costs is the amount of labor that it takes the person to draw the water up out of the well. And, like, if they need to bring the water to somewhere far away, the cost will go up because it takes more socially necessary labor to get the water from the well to that other person.
Yeah.
But, like, if that other person has a well of their own, even though a lot of labor goes into bringing the well, like, the water to them, it's not going to cost very much because the labor to do that is unnecessary in terms of that social engagement. So I think, like, part of what this article is saying is, like, in the circumstances where you're an airline, like, attendant, you're being put in a situation where, like, your labor is being deemed, like, socially necessary. Like, you're being told you have to act this way as part of, like, your social labor that goes into, like, this exchange of, like, people buying tickets and giving them good reviews on their flights. Whereas there's a, you know, a social contract that goes into, you know, like, arguing with your partner about something. Like, there's an expected contract of, like, what is good practice when tensions are high and, like, you're both mad at each other. But it's not going into this social product that is going out to other people in the world specifically.
Yeah, because, like, with, I think with, like, being a flight attendant, like, it's so, the performance is there as a way to sort of negate the emergence of the power dynamics and, like, the sacrifices that, like, might be present emotionally or, like, physically in the person who's working. But I think in marriages, there's issues when, like, the emotional labor isn't recognized. And that's obviously a much more, like, a long-term engagement versus just, like, a flight. And I think it's, I feel like there has to be, like, emotional labor on both sides in a marriage, but it has to be, like, recognized. But I think with, like, when it's, like, a job, there is compensation. So there's, like, that sacrifice is therefore more okay because you're being paid for it.
Yeah. I think also, like, the issue is, like, because I think, like, because in the piece, like, they talk about, like, the problem with calling that emotional labor is that it becomes a defensive term, right? Like, it's like, I have a certain expectation about that reflects both how, in this case, like, the woman would behave that is reflected back to like how the expectation of like the man should behave that overlooks actually a deeper like systemic problem in terms of like the issue of like women not being able to say certain things or having to do a lot of work isn't explained by using the term, oh, I'm putting in emotional labor. Like it's something beyond that.
Yeah. But at the same time, if there is the pressure placed on the woman in the relationship to sort of like describe the dynamics of the emotional labor, as opposed to like said male in a relationship who sort of has the privilege of being able to be unaware of them, there should be like a pressure on him to be aware of it. But at the same time, I think like the writer makes a good point about how if you just sort of say like any sort of discussion of systemic inequity and emotional labor is just emotional labor, then it like it negates like the root problem for sure.
Yeah, there's another piece where someone talks about that article and kind of expands on certain things. And they say there's been a recent backlash against this, quote, we have no responsibility to educate you, end quote, sentiment, often justified in emotional labor, but the backlash is on tactical grounds. After all, there are plenty of people who are opposed or ignorant of someone's experience, perfectly willing to offer a counter-narrative for free. Yet beyond that, I think we should be honest that commodification of our own experiences probably increases our own alienation in regards to that experience. Instead of normalizing our traumas through exposure and helping others see our points of view, we set it off as trauma that is too much to bear without specific compensation. So I think what the issue is that it, rather than it being an actual someone saying like the emotional labor of explaining to a partner or doing household work, it doesn't become a conversation about like how do we not have that dynamic. It becomes a like, oh, at my job I get paid for emotional labor, why aren't you paying me for emotional labor at home?
I think that's sort of an overstatement of the idea, but I think it is dangerous to dismiss the dynamics as purely emotional labor. But at the same time, there is like, it's kind of like when someone and this happens in like racially and it's like when someone sort of asks a queer person about and asks them like to explain like queer issues to them, as opposed to them taking like the responsibility of just sort of like looking it up. And at the same time,
see, I have like, an issue with that though. Like, there's so much assumption that goes into that.
Yeah, and I think it's like, because at the same time, if you sort of like say like, oh, it's emotional labor, I can't explain to you, you're sort of negating the possibility of a conversation that could be like very illuminating or very helpful. And I think it depends on like to what extent someone's asking you, like if they're like actually like curious and it's like you're close with them, or like if they're your partner, that's like different, as opposed to someone like messaging you on Facebook and being like, explain intersectionality to me, which would be like actually emotional labor. Or that's not the best example, but I think it depends a lot on the context.
I think that's true, but I think it's also like, I think there's a very high double standard that goes into play with the way that people say like, oh, you have the time to go look this up when that happens. I mean, it depends on like, yeah, if someone just randomly messages you directly on Facebook and it's like, you're the first trans person I've ever seen, explain to me how this works. But like,
yeah.
People constantly on the one hand are like, gosh, there's so much misinformation and like, you just can't, like, really, you're just not going to be able to figure out what's true and what's not. And like, and then someone's like, well, can you actually explain to me this? Oh, but you should look it up. Like, that constantly plays out.
Yeah, and I've definitely, like, I've seen that, like, witnessed it happen. But I also think, like, it is easier to tell someone to like look it up than to sort of like risk the vulnerability of you explaining something and then having the risk of them just sort of like negate your experience.
Well, but that, so, I think nobody ever like takes the ground of like, oh, this is a trustworthy explanation. Like, you don't have to explain it on your own personal, like, being, true. Though.
Yeah. And it's not always, like, heavily personal, but I think there's definitely a balance of people discussing, like, having those conversations and people, and I think people should be responsible for educating themselves on issues as opposed to sort of relying on people to explain them said issues. But I think like it's like both are obviously like important.
Well, again, I would say that the class dynamics there are very troubling in terms of accessibility to actually do that.
Yeah.
In terms of,
yeah,
looking at who actually knows most like cultural things.
Yeah. That's a really good point. Because I think that's what a lot of those arguments like don't take into consideration, like who has access to information.
Because like, I know that there was a big study about how like the Black Lives Matter movement, when it first started out, was primarily composed of working class Black people, and then within roughly 2 years, it was all middle class college students.
Whoa!
Like it's like completely shifted, like. And, like, the actual, like, goals and complaints have, like, drastically changed because of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, because now I think sometimes people will, like, sort of, like, leverage sort of critical theory about race over people. And, like, while it's important, there is a sort of, like, gatekeeping of ideas within that.
Well, because, like, I know Adolph Reed Jr., who was, like, part of the New Left in the 60s, and he's African-American, has written a lot about, like, his... I mean, I think he goes kind of excessively, but he talks a lot about, like, the... the way that, like, representation has become like a big deal politically for like middle class people that aren't like white men, mm-hmm. but that it doesn't actually do much in terms of like overall well-being of like people in disparaged communities.
Yeah.
Like he had like a huge, he has like this big critique of like where he talks about like Black Panther, like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said like, like he's talked about like why do like, well, he's using the term we as in like persons of color, like not me, he's using the term we, like he quote says like why do we continually have to find like an example of like a single Black hero that is like representative of us instead of having movies that are like actually about like the communal like historically accurate Black experiences.
Yeah, as like opposed to like tokenizing, yeah, like one. And yeah,
he was like, really, like the best we can do is we can think of like a superhero who's a king, like that, like, yeah, rules over other Black people, like or like, because he talks about his favorite movie is the movie Glory, mm-hmm. which is like the movie, have you seen that?
I haven't, no.
It's about the like the all Black like section of the army in the Civil War. The first like all Black it's not a unit, like a company, I guess. And he talks about like when it came out, that was one of the first times that people talked about like white savior narratives, and he was like, I didn't understand what they meant because like the main officers that run the company are white.
Yeah.
But he was like, well, that's true. Like, that's how things worked. But the focus of the movie isn't on the white officers making the black people better. Most of the narrative of the movie, like, yes, there are white people in leadership roles, like, in terms of the internal narrative context, but he points out that, like, the actual character development that gets focused on is the intercommunal, like, narrative of all the, like, black soldiers going on. And he was like, to me, this is a much better, like, even if, like, yes, like, the officers are white, the actual narrative development in terms of the historical conditions and, like, development of, like, personal agency and communal agency are much better than just, like, we have one awesome super black dude who can, like, run fast and wears a super suit, like, kind of thing.
And I think, like, that's, like, I think people will, like, use representation as sort of, like, and, like, representation in, like, film and, like, other sort of media forms, like, does change perception. But I think it also, like, I think the effects are sometimes, like, overstated.
Yeah. Well, and it's, like, one of those things that's, like, you know, to some degree, I understand, the game company I used to work for, they have a policy where they, like, intentionally try to have, like, lots of, like, skin tones and, like, in their character art, like, lots of skin tones and, like, images of characters that are, like, lots of different genders or that are, like, gender ambiguous and, like, that's, like, a principle of, like, how they, like, attempt to, like, have their products and their, like, narrative design and stuff. And I'm like, okay, yeah, like, that's a good general practice to have in terms of, like, what they're doing and what they want to represent. But I wouldn't go out and be like, this is the basis of our political platform. It's like,
like
more products that have various people that we can sell to.
I know. And I can, because I think, like, then it's, but at the same time, like, there's this whole idea of, like, symbolic annihilation and how, like, if there is, like, actually, like, no representation, then it does have, like psychological, like, effects on people in terms of, like, what they project themselves into being.
I guess.
And, like representation isn't, like, equivalent to, like, huge, like, legislative change. But at the same time, like, if there were, like, in the 1950s or, like, the 40s, there was, like representations of, like, women was, like, non-existent / terrible. And that, like, did affect people and how they sort of projected themselves in the future.
I mean, I do think it's important. Like, there's, like, the whole story about, I don't remember the actress's name, but she played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was the, might have been, I know she, like, it, like, that was, like, a huge, like, you know, person of color playing, like, a major role. I think it was the first time they had an interracial kiss happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there's, like, a story about, like, you know, Whoopi Goldberg, when she was a kid, like, saw it on the TV and, like, ran to her mom and was like, there's a black lady on the TV that isn't a maid or something like that. And, like, I think MLK Jr., like, called the actress to say, like, because she was going to retire or something, or, like, leave the show, and he was like, don't do it. Like, your representation is, like, really inspiring. But I think there's an issue of, like, is representation being used as, like, when is it being used, like, actually as a means of, like, inspiring and commenting on things, and, like, when is it being used as a, like, marketing or, like,
yeah, because, like, so much of, like, representation, like Parks and Rec, for example, like, a lot of it is, like, tokenizing, like, certain, like, racial and gendered stereotypes, but at the same time, there's, like, I don't know, like, there is representation, even though it's problematic, and there is, like, other forms of media that, like, does have, like, representation that I think we sort of take for granted now.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways.
Well, that's the other thing about it, is that the general trend is, like, the groups that get represented on, like, TV are, like, easily traceable by which groups are getting more money to buy things. Like,
yeah.
Like, you're probably not going to see a whole lot of representation of, like, Native Americans on reservations, like, in-depth characters, because, like, they're not going to be watching TV putting income into the system because of that representation. Like, yeah. There's not that class basis to, like, market to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, you know, like, Black, like that's the thing, is, like, if you look at, like, Black Panther started in comic books, inner city African-American kids were a big, like, thing for that because comic books are cheap.
Yeah.
Like, so that it was, like, something that they could afford to do to, like, have all this, like, which isn't to say that it's not, like, radical or important, but it's, like, mm-hmm. the people that could afford to do that were the people who are making products that, you know, Black people in that time could afford.
Yeah, so it is sort of like the killing two birds with one stone, but being like, mm-hmm. oh, here's representation, but also mm-hmm. we want to market to you.
Yeah, like, now, like, it's like, oh, like, we can, like, or it's like with Modern Family, like, they have, like, the gay couple on mm-hmm. it that's like the, that's very like this is like this, suddenly this is a huge portion of, like, the new middle class that, like,
yeah,
is being represented.
For sure.
So, is there anything else we want to cover?
I don't think so. I think we were pretty thorough in the past hour or so. Is there anything else that you want to bring up?
As a form of awareness, it's
covered it pretty
highly specialist.
Along with, like, the other stuff that we kind of just jumped around talking about, too.
Commodification is not simply an asymmetric relation of power.
Could you elaborate on this? Could you elaborate? You perhaps do a move, go and work, okay?
Wait a minute, why can't I get my opinion? This is a free country?
He can give you. Do you have to give it so loud?